Good evening, everybody. It's nice to have you all here. Fusatsu, any of you who are experiencing this for the first time, is a particular liturgy that is part of our tradition. But the roots of it go back to the Buddha. During the time of the Buddha, as soon as he began to develop a sangha, who were committed to the path and to a way, which was based in a very clear and committed moral life. There were deviations. His students, his ordained monastics, did not always live according to their vows, and all of his students were like this. And so there needed to be a way to allow each person to reflect on that, to take responsibility for their lives and their practice and their actions and the consequences of their actions, and then to renew their commitment, to atone, to address those consequences, and specifically within the context of the Sangha itself, because this originally was within the ordained community. And so in order both to maintain an individual as well as a community integrity, there were regular meetings where the Sangha would gather and they would read through their vows, and anyone who had transgressed would then have the opportunity to come forward and take responsibility for that and to take on whatever, you know, the address of that needed to be, and in that way move forward. So that both individually and as a Sangha, they weren't accumulating the negative karma of unaddressed negative actions. And so we do this through Fusatsu. And I'm not going to do this tonight. I've done this before where I went through the liturgy and the Fusatsu itself, the structure of it, if you will, as a way of you know, trying to show how, well, let me say this another way. Think about, you know, on your own, think about what we've just done, what's happening now, and what will follow as we conclude after the talk. And not just from an intellectual perspective, but if we are here to do this, we are here to reflect on our own actions and to take responsibility for any actions that in which we've created negative karma, and we're going to do that together, what should we do? How should we do that? And so Fusatsu is our tradition's a formal response to that. And so just think about that question in response, in relationship to what we have done. And not just what we've chanted, but also what have you been doing with your body? Right? So we've taken various positions or postures in the last bit of liturgy. Sometimes we were standing, sometimes we were prostrating, sometimes we were in chokki, which is what the kneeling position, right? What were we turning our attention to when we were doing those various practice postures? So we're turning towards the Buddha. Okay, what are the words that we're bringing forth? Remember that karma is thoughts, words, and actions. And so in liturgy, we bring those three wheels together. And so think about, you know, as we focus on the body-mind study of the way, how that is happening right now during this Fusatsu. And so rather than just think, oh, well, we're always bowing, and so we'll put in a bow here. Or we do a lot of gassho, so, you know, we just got a show here. Don't think of it. Try not to think of it that way. These are not automatic gestures. Okay, they're very profound gestures. You can think of your whole body as a mudra. You can think of a prostration as a mudra. You can think of standing, kneeling, and chokhi as a kind of mudra. In other words, each of these postures, if you sort of connect with what's happening inside of you, you experience it in a different way. When you're standing, when you're sitting, when you're in chokhi, when you're in gassho, when you're not in gassho. And so just to sort of reflect on, not so much, you know, to try and analyze it, but just to reflect on what's the actual experience that's happening as you're doing that. Because that's really the way to practice it, is to be inside of the experience, right? But also the whole experience. And so when you're in chokhi and you're chanting the Gatha of Atonement, that you're the body and mind study of the way, is you're taking that whole experience in, right? It's not just words. But it is words. It's meaning, but it's also, there's a physical aspect to this, right? Because we're physical beings. We live in a physical world. And that's a really important part of practice, right? How we use that and how we are affected by that. And so these practices that are unfamiliar to us perhaps in the beginning and then become familiar over time, in that we can stop paying attention. And so what I'm suggesting is to do that. Bring your attention to it and just reflect on how you're experiencing that in the course of this very particular liturgy, which has a very particular purpose. Dogen, in his fascicle that we're studying, says, just turn this body around, abandoning the 10 unwholesome actions, keeping the 8 precepts, taking refuge in the 3 treasures, and leaving home and entering the homeless life is the true study of the way. For this reason, it is called the true human body. Actually, I think I want to go back to what I was just saying and put this talk that I prepared aside. What is the true human body? In this fascicle, when Dogen speaks about the true human body, he's talking about your body, but he's not limiting the body to your arms and legs, torso, head, and feet. When he talks about the mind, study with mind, he's talking about everything that we normally associate with mind, but he's talking about much more than that. And this is part of the challenge of our practice and training, and particularly in this tradition, the Zen tradition, because there's a very free and exploding use of language. You know, language, in a sense, is often used to contain things, right? It kind of domesticates reality by giving it a name, right? And the name then takes on meaning. And then we have a sense of, oh, okay, I understand this, I know what this is. And that we become trapped in that. And so what much of the language in Zen is trying to do, understanding this very, very intricate, intimate relationship that we have in our consciousness with language and with words and with the karma that they create, and that when we speak, we're not only speaking and sending that out, but we're also hearing our own words, right? So it comes back to us. So we're not just influencing the field in which we're living, but we're also influencing our own minds, right? This is why, you know, the thoughts that we have matter. It's not just a matter of thinking or not thinking. You know, the distractedness is distracted and prevents us from experiencing things directly. That's true. But there's more than that, because when we're talking to ourselves as well as to others, but because, you know, we're mostly talking to ourselves, because that can happen all the time, anytime. Even when we're talking to somebody else, we can simultaneously be talking to ourselves. right? That has a profound influence on us, right? What are we saying? What is the content, right? And while in the beginning of practice, we can often be humbled and embarrassed by the kind of blathering nature a lot of that content, but that has impact too. You know, one of the four ways in which the Buddha talked about the misuse of language was idle chatter. Uh-oh. Right? I mean, that's probably what? 80, 90%? Right? You do your own stats. But it's a big chunk of what's going on in our own mind. So why did he say, along with lying, along with using speech like a weapon to actually cause injury, along with using speech like a wall to create boundaries and divide? Right? So those are three very powerful misuses of speech. Right? That's easy to understand. And then there's idle chatter. Right? Doesn't that kind of seem like that should be in a different kind of category? But it's not. So he recognized that that has a power that on some level is comparable, is to be taken seriously as these other form misuses of language. Kind of interesting. And so then we can think of liturgy as a way of employing language in a new way, in a different way, in a healing way, in a liberating way, in an exploding way. And so then when we bring together that with a mudra, right, that what we do with our body, to turn this body around, right, to turn this body around. So this body is moving in a certain direction. It's got a trajectory. It's got a mission. It's driven by something, by a way of seeing things, by a desire, by attachments, to turn this body around and move in another direction, to change the course of things. And to do that at the same time that you're doing that with language, with words. One of the most powerful forces in the human world. Words, language, meaning. I mean, think of it. They're in the middle of every conflict. They're at the beginning of every war. They're at the middle. They're at the end. We dream with words. We can create intimacy with words. We can ruin lives with words. This power that we have and that we use so idly, as the Buddha said. Now, you know, we can get trapped in that too because we think, okay, I can never say a simple thing again. I remember I had a friend years ago who said that she only wanted to have deeply meaningful conversations, and I thought, ooh. And it's interesting how sometimes light conversation, I see this at the monastery all the time. I think those of us who live there or have lived there see this all the time. People come in, they're there for the first time. This has happened between us. Right? All of us who have been there or come for the first time, and we have a simple conversation. But a simple conversation can have depth, right? It can be a way of making contact. It can be a way of showing that you care. And so idle chatter doesn't just mean having simple conversation. It means being idle. It's like wasteful language. It's using it wastefully, not recognizing the power that it is. And so when we think of that, and then this body, right, which has the ability to express through its physicality, and also at the same time, just with language, to express inward and to influence our consciousness. That's what we do with the body in practice. That is the function of a mudra. That is what's happening when you sit on the cushion. It's not just a matter of balance. There's something that happens in this posture. There's something that is being expressed in a visible form, a tangible form that has its roots in a very, very deep place within us that has been discovered, has become known through the ancient wisdoms of practitioners, right, who have investigated such things very deeply. But many religions, many spiritual practices, virtually all, it would seem safe to say, use the body, use words, create karma. But what the Buddha understood is that alone is not enough. Not enough to practice. That what is essential, perhaps even the most important part of all, is your mind. What are you doing with your mind? And so to unify the mind, and that in that it's not an abstraction. And so in that, when you're chanting the Gatha of Atonement, right, and there's the words and the meaning of that, all evil karma ever created by me since of old. And you say those words from your heart. In other words, you say them in such a way as though you want to be in the center of what that's communicating. You want to go to the ground of that. All evil karma ever created by me since of old. You're not shy or timid. You're not fearful of what you might find there. You're not trying to maintain control by knowing what it means, or by having already decided, you know, that's not me, or I know what this is. In other words, your mind is wide open, and you allow yourself to go into the ground, into the center of being of that, all evil karma ever created by me since of old. You're not looking for an experience. There's not something special that is supposed to happen. You go in not knowing. And those words, that line formed together with the meaning that you understand is the doorway to that. And it's inside of your body, and it's in your voice, and it's in your mind. In other words, where could you locate it? It's the whole. And that while you're doing that, your hands are in gassho, right? And you're standing, you're kneeling in chokyi, which is a very interesting posture, right? It's not a posture that we normally take. Standing, we know. Standing, both feet are on the ground, right? Upright. Standing tall. Being able to see far ahead, right? Ready to move. Forwards or backwards, right? Seated on the cushion, you're like a mountain. You're not going anywhere. You know, that's why the postures are actually different, you know, not just anatomically, but the way they actually affect us. And so, you know, it's important when we're, you know, inviting people into practice Zazen that we, you know, sort of present this range of postures, because everybody has a different body. And there are bodies that can do certain things, but not other things, right? And so to have an access into Zazen, you know, we try and create a kind of open door access to each of these postures, to Zazen through each of these postures, right? And that's important and that's true. And then whatever that posture is that you take, you make that work, because you can. Right? The posture cannot prevent you from sitting deeply, whether you're sitting in a chair or you're sitting on the floor. And at the same time, when you sit cross-legged, when you sit in a lotus position, when you sit in a full lotus position, it's different, right? So if you can't do that, it's okay. But it's if you have some range of choice or ability to expand into different choices, I would encourage you to work with that, right? Because when you're sitting on the floor in a lotus position or for a lotus, you know you're not going anywhere, right? And that affects you in a different kind of way. There's a reason why when you go into Dokusan, the posture is seiza. You can move in quickly, you can take your position, and it's a sort of greater state of alertness in a certain kind of way because there's something that's happening. Right? So these postures actually have different effects. And so then you're in Chokyi, right? Your hands are in Gassho, you're facing the Buddha. All evil karma ever committed by me sensible. And so Chokyi is a little unstable, right? You're not standing squarely on the ground. You're not seated on the ground. You're not in transition. It's a posture by itself, but it's a little, right? What is that? What's happening there? And what are you saying? What are we chanting as we're in that position, right? So when you sit on the floor, there's a kind of, you're the whole universe, right? When you're standing, you're ready to respond. You know, both of these are very powerful postures. When you're in Chokyi, this is also a very powerful posture, but in my experience, in a kind of a different way. In a way, it's a kind of posture of humility. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and delusion, born of my body, mouth, and thought, now I atone for it all. To turn this body around, this true human body, for this reason it is called the true human body. You know, when things move so fast, you know, it's like when you're driving or you're in a train. You know, you can look out the window and see the landscape passing by. When you slow down, you see it a little differently. When you're riding a bike, you see it differently still. And it's not just seeing, you actually experience it differently. You see things that you didn't see when you were driving. You see things you didn't see when you were driving fast. And then when you get off the bike and you start walking, something altogether different happens. And then when you stop walking and you just stand, something again different happens. And our mind is kind of like that, right? And our study is kind of like that. The Dharma is a lot like that. You know, we live in such a fast time that I think if the Buddha was born today, I don't know. He was the Buddha, so he'd pull it off. Right? But the forces, right? The sort of conduciveness of that kind of deep, painstaking study, and not just the Buddha, but people of that time, and the times that followed that would spend that amount of time studying this, examining the mind, examining language, examining a text. And so, you know, I just think it's important as the inheritors of this tradition, that we try and actually receive the inheritance and to appreciate this I wanted to say magnitude, I wanted to say majesty of having this particular form, this physical body, this consciousness, this language, our ability to communicate, our senses, and to see how in practice we're actually learning how to utilize this, right? And we're giving these very, you know, in a sense, very simple ways of being that because they're so simple, we might just pass by and not notice. And so, you know, when you put yourself inside of what you're doing, like in a prostration, something that can happen that will not happen otherwise. In other words, that action, that body, that true human body in that moment can speak of truths and of things that we will not experience otherwise, because that's a particular mudra. That's a particular moment in the life of this. Right? And so to think about that in relationship to the Buddha's four postures, standing, sitting, walking, lying down, we could look at that as in a very sort of, you know, functional way. So when you're sitting, you're doing meditation. When you're standing, you're doing kinnin, right? Or walking. When you're laying down, you know, in other words, practice, be aware in all those postures. But that would be kind of true, but it's looking at it a little bit superficially, right? Rather than to look at each of those as a posture in and of itself that has its own expression, that has its own effect on us being physical beings. Kind of interesting. Might be worthwhile to slow down enough to look into that, right?
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.